Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future, live or on demand. I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, can Johannesburg's new bomb squad really fix a city in decay? Business confidence edges up, but is South Africa's optimism justified? Why South Africa's wealthiest are drowning in debt and billions spent on CSI, yet inequality remains the world's worst. It's Thursday, the 4th of September. South Africa's business confidence slipping again in the third quarter, with the RMB BER index edging down to 39, a level that suggests or signals more than 60% of business leaders currently are unhappy with conditions. It's a worrying figure. The numbers suggest an economy that's muddling through rather than gaining momentum, and it's weighed down by things like tariffs, rising costs, and continued structural blockage. I want to explore this all in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Isaiah Mhlanga, who's chief economist at Rand Merchant Bank. Isaiah, business confidence then sitting below the long-term average. Are we now stuck in permanent stagnation, do you think?
Look, if we look at these levels, it's really confidence levels that say the economy is in muddle through. The overall confidence, however, masks underlying moves at a sectoral level. If you look at the five subsectors, you see that two of the subsectors show a significant jump in confidence, while three showed a decline. New vehicle dealers, significant jump of 12 points to 54. Building contractors, jumped by 11 points to 46. On the other hand, you have wholesale dealers that declined by 12 points to 38. Retailers declined by 10 points to 32, and manufacturers that have the least confidence at 23 points declined by 10 points. So it does shows you that there are different, sentiment levels at a sectoral level, but the overall business confidence shows relatively flat or, a marginal decline to 39.
Isaiah, let me pick you up on retail confidence, which, as you say, fell sharply. Yet interesting to read that there are pockets like furniture retail, for instance, which are doing a whole lot better. What does that split tell us about consumer behavior?
It is really the underlying drivers of that consumer behavior. Furniture retailers are sensitive to interest rates. We saw the SARB cutting interest rates by 25 basis points in July, and still signaled that should they get their 3% inflation target confirmed by National Treasury, the path going forward would be lower inflation and lower interest rates. So that would naturally lift confidence of interest rate sensitive sectors such as furniture retailers. But also, this is a sector that tends to be supported by higher income earners that are more resilient overall. But it does say to us, conditions or policy decisions elsewhere can impact, these subsectors. From an employment perspective, we don't expect much employment gains, which would then imply that, some of the retailers that are dependent on low-end consumers are not going to be resilient from their confidence perspective.
Of particular concern is manufacturing, which is at its lowest confidence level. I'm assuming that a lot of the slide is directly linked to US tariffs as well as structural weakness, but it is surely a red flag for our export competitiveness.
Big red flag. The survey coinciding with the implementation of the 30% tariffs from the US as far as our exports is concerned. but you also see expectations of our markets being flooded by, you know, offshore manufactured products. We see that in the automotive space, there is some expectation that this is going to extend beyond the automotive space. But more so, the cost of you know, electricity, the administrative burden at a local level, you know, and also competing imports, which I mentioned just now, add to the burden for local you know, local manufacturers. So the whole issues of logistics and structural issues that we're trying to address with economic reforms add to that weight. So it's both the global issues on tariffs, but also domestic constraints on things that we can do something about that continues to drag manufacturing confidence lower.
And added to that problem, obviously, is you highlighting municipal service failures as a growing drag. And there's little sign that we're seeing any real local government reform in that respect. If we did, maybe that would impact a little more positively on confidence.
Indeed, the local government featured quite a lot in terms of the administrative burden, the approval of permits taking way too long at a local government level, which is why at an Operation Vulindlela level, the addition of local government reforms is a welcome development. We just need to see this being fast-tracked so that we get to resolve some of these issues quicker than what we have seen in other areas of economic reforms. We hope the issues that are coming with local government elections next year are not going to delay this, because delaying that would mean a delayed investment process, as we've seen this year, which would also mean a delayed job creation and economic growth.
Difficult, of course, to fast track, as you suggest, and you call for a speeding up of reform in logistics, water and governance, but those bottlenecks still are very intractable.
Indeed, intractable, which is why we continue to see modest growth for this year. But we have to look on the bright side. If we look at the economic reforms, we have seen some movements of late. You know, business leadership, South Africa's economic reform tracker, does suggest that we have seen, you know, quite a sizable reform implementation that should give us confidence that though the short-term growth expectations are muddled through, the medium to longer-term growth expectations should be far more optimistic than what is currently embedded in economic forecasts.
The South African Reserve Bank is signaling a 3% inflation target that's been widely reported. Do you see this helping or hurting business sentiment?
It should help business sentiment. A lower inflation target, once it's confirmed and agreed upon by policymakers and officially announced, which we think eventually it will be, perhaps, or you know, at the earliest at the MTBPS, or at the latest next year at the budget. What it means is inflation expectations will be lower going forward. In any case, if you look at the adjustments of the cost of borrowing for the state, has already taken place since May. You have seen across the yield curve, bond yields decline by an average of 70 basis points, even though growth has not improved. Even though from a policy perspective, we haven't seen major announcements outside of this inflation targeting by the SARB. So it only says it's monetary policy that have contributed to that decline in the cost of borrowing for the state. And this cascades down into the overall economy. So once you have this inflation risk premium being lowered, you can then have lower interest rate, which means the cost of borrowing for all consumers and corporates is also lower, which is where you see subsectors such as new vehicle dealers' confidence improving. It is on the expectations that interest rates in future will be lower.
Just a final question. Confidence at 39 is not enough to drive investment. What number will it take to start realistically shifting that needle?
Typically, confidence above 50 means at least half of the respondents are optimistic. That's where you need confidence to be, at the very minimum. So we need confidence level that are above 50 for us to see, you know, significant confidence boost. As they say, confidence is the cheapest form of stimulus. We need to see all of these reforms and politicians and business working together to boost, that confidence that provide the private sector with the, stimulus to actually invest in the economy and create jobs.
Thank you very much indeed. Isaiah Mhlanga is the chief economist at Rand Merchant Bank.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, Johannesburg's so-called bomb squad, you'll remember, was launched in June, led by ANC Veterans League President Dr. Snooki Zikalala. The idea was bold, a high-impact task team to fight lawlessness and speed up service delivery with a two-year deadline to make a real difference. Now, supporters say it's a much-needed injection of urgency, but critics are arguing it's undemocratic. It lacks a constitutional mandate and has so far shown minimal results. And residents obviously want to know whether this is real change or just political theatre. I'm in conversation now with Dr. Zikalala. Snooki, a very warm welcome to you, and maybe a starting point, having done the assessment, how would you describe the current state of Johannesburg, and how long do you think it's going to realistically take to turn the city around?
Well, it will take time, as you know, that the city is in decay, and the number one, as you know, that secondly is that the infrastructure is in serious problems. And as you know, that there is lawlessness, general lawlessness within the city itself. And as you know, that the community does as they wish. And there are a lot of water tankering, Johannesburg Mafia, which deals with electricity. There's a lot of illegal connections. But I think the people of Johannesburg are keen to make sure that we turn the city around. And of course, we've met with a number of civil organizations, and we're still going to meet with them. They are the ones who are giving us support, saying that this is what is needed. And we work with the citizens. We work with the, especially with, from council side, with the speaker, because we get all the complaints coming from citizens through the speaker, and we follow up. And so I think citizens want to see change in Johannesburg, and change will happen because we intervene physically. We don't just send emails, do this. When there's when a CRAM is involved with high impact service delivery issues, we go with CRAM, with CRAM those areas, and make sure that things are resolved instantaneously. And so that's what you do. For instance, we went to Yeovil together with the law enforcement agencies, together with the water, electricity, with people from city power. We disconnected a number of illegal connections within Yeovil. Secondly, we made sure that there's an issue which was related to water leakage in Yeovil. That water was leaking for 7 years, and within 3 hours, We rectified that water. Make sure that Joburg Water brings a truck. They dig out. They immediately find where the problem is, and they immediately resolve the issue that took 7 years to be resolved. And so we are saying that this is instantaneous service delivery that you want to see within the city itself.
Why did it come to this? Why do we need the so-called bomb squad? Surely this is work that the city itself should have been capacitated to do.
Well, we need it because there's urgency. Society is very angry. Society, irrespective of which political party you come from, society wants to see quality service in the city. Society is not sitting back and say, we'll wait for 2 years if another party comes to power. But we have to fix it now. And we are not interfering with management. We don't have the right to interfere with workers. We deal directly with the mayor. It's the mayor who gives instructions, and because we are appointed by the mayor. And so we don't deal with the question of tenders. There's nothing to do with us. We're making sure that those who are employed to do the work, they do it adequately, and they do it with agency. And workers don't complain. Workers are very happy. They are really enthused that they're working with us. And so we are very happy with what is happening.
You talk about a city in decay. You talk about a long-term fix, yet the mayor promised quick results from June the 1st. Do you think he was being a little overambitious?
No, he has to be overambitious. As a mayor, you have to be overambitious because you want to achieve your goals. And so we are there to make sure that the city works and the city delivers on its promises to the citizens of Johannesburg.
The bomb squad's legal and constitutional mandate has been questioned. Where does council or the law authorize your exact role? Opposition parties call this a PR stunt and something that is actually making little progress at all.
Well, there's Section 56(2)(d), where the municipal of municipal structures, the mayor is entitled to use that section to to bring in people who support him. And so I think it's a legal issue, and the mayor is sought advice, and he is empowered to bring in people on board who will be able to support him, and making sure that the city does its work adequately and the city delivers on its promises to society.
Are you confident that the city is able to deliver on that, though, or is it simply overwhelmed?
Why should I not be confident? We are confident. When we were fighting against apartheid, we were always confident. We knew that the South African army is very powerful, but we were determined, committed, and we were prepared to risk our lives to bring about change and democracy in South Africa. And so what will make us not too confident? We're confident that we definitely will succeed.
What do you see as the single biggest challenge facing Johannesburg right now in order to rectify the situation, the city that you describe as one in decay?
Well, the biggest challenge is the question of infrastructure, because it's in decay, number one. Number two is the question of illegality. We have a lot of illegal immigrants who are coming into the city. And I think Home Affairs must do its work. It must make sure that those who are illegal in the country itself, they must be made legal. Those who are illegal and do not have documents, they must be taken back to their countries. For instance, we went to Yeovil, the former Yeovil police station. It is dilapidated, that place. There were something like 80 people staying there, and it was a mess. There's no electricity, and when we tried to find out from people, some of them are illegal, and so we must deal with illegal people who have entered the country, and they must be dealt with properly. They must be taken back to their countries, and so those who are not refugees, who want to be legal in the country, let them do so authoritatively.
Is the bomb squad prepared to commit to publishing independent performance audits about the work that you're doing?
Yes, we're prepared. We can even give you statistics of what they've done over the last 2 months. We can. Issues that we have resolved. For instance, if there's water sewage now in an area that has been sent to us, within 24 hours, that water sewage will be resolved.
Do you think people in Johannesburg are being a little impatient about the scope and the speed with which you are working at? Communities like El Dorado Park, for instance, Snooki, are still complaining about poor service. Why has your intervention not reached them, for instance?
No, the people have to be impatient because people have been abused. They have to be impatient. They want to see their issues being resolved. When I'm talking about El Dorado Park, in June, there was a complaint coming from the speaker that citizens in one area, they had sewage passing in front of their doors, in front of their house for 10 years, and there's been no resolve in terms of those issues. We went together with bomb squad members, we went to Joburg Water. We resolved that issue, which had taken place for the last 10 years. We resolved it within two days. And what was disappointing is that when we were at the war room, with the war rooms, which you call the, when you find out exactly what needs to be done, one of the Joburg manager, when we asked them about El Dorado Park, why is the sewage not been resolved? No, it's the issue of a diameter. We need a bigger pipe. I said, have you been there? No, I've not been there. But this, I said, okay, fine. I'm not fighting you. I'm just asking you. And the following day, we took the MD of Joburg Water, went to Elders, and we saw the sewage was there. And we then asked the MD of Joburg Water, can this be fixed within 2 days? He said, it'll be fixed. Can you see that your employee has not been here? And he said, yes, I can see. And so now, why does he tell us that it was an issue of a diameter of the pipe? And so he said, no, there's no diameter of the pipe. Our people were not here. I said, can you make sure within 2 days that is resolved? And it was resolved within 2 days. I said to them, it was on a Friday. On Sunday, I'm coming back to Elders to see whether you're working, you're resolving this issue. On Sunday in the morning, instead of going to church, I went to Elders. I found that the workers were there, were resolving that issue.
All right, just a final question, and very briefly, there is the criticism that with the G20 summit ahead, the bomb squad is more about optics than outcomes. How do you answer that?
No, it's about outcomes, not optics. It's about outcomes. And so we are not doing it because of G20. We're doing it because we want to change people's lives. People should live better in their own city.
Dr. Snooki Zikalala, thank you very much indeed, running the Johannesburg Bomb Squad.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this is a worrying trend. Even South Africa's wealthiest are showing signs of economic strain. According to the latest credit stress report by the research and consulting firm 8020, the top 5% of earners, termed the heavy hitters, now spend nearly 48% of their income on debt repayment. Collectively, they hold a staggering 1.7 trillion rand in debt, making up 65% of the country's total. More alarmingly, overdue home loan balances rising by almost 5% in a single quarter, despite assumptions that the segment is financially invincible. I want to discuss what this means for the economy and also the future of credit in South Africa from 8020. Andrew Fulton, welcome back to the program. And let's wade straight in with the reason. Why are we seeing affluent South Africans, and they're often seen as financially bulletproof, suddenly drowning in debt? And I don't think I'm overstating that.
Yeah, hello, Jeremy. Nice to be on the show again. I'll climb right into it. We've kind of noticed this trend for quite a while. One of the things that has been happening is debt has been increasingly concentrated in fewer hands, and those have been the wealthier South Africans. But certainly, if you look at the top 5% of South Africans, I mean, they include, you know, the very, very top of people that are making hundreds of thousands, if not millions a month. But they also include sort of like the upper class, which in South Africa is generally, you know, when you're making above sort of 60,000, 70,000 rand a month. And those people have been stretched in a number of different ways. You know, we've come out of a very high inflation environment. You know, the drops in the repo rate, the prime lending rate, haven't really kicked in a huge way just yet. And the salary growth has been fairly negligible since COVID. BankServe data shows that in the last sort of year or two, it's started to pick up. But a lot of data shows that salaries, very recently were at the same levels they were in 2017, 2018. So what you really have is people being stretched in terms of their disposable income and leaning into their home loans in order to access cash. And overextending their credit cards in order to make ends meet at the end of the month.
Andrew, the figure I find staggering is 48% of income on debt repayment, which is staggering. It also tells us something very starkly, does it not, about lifestyle expectation versus hard reality in South Africa in 2025.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, once again, you know, that group that we call the heavy hitters, a lot of that, the majority of that value of loans is home loan and vehicle assets. So those are large loans, which, you know, you're paying 4,000, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 a month for your home loan or your car loan. So that's why it's such a large chunk of your income.
If we look at the big number of 1.7 trillion rand in debt held by this very small group of heavy hitters, there are implications surely for the broader financial system.
Yeah, I mean, I think worldwide, you know, there's concerns around the economy. A lot of people overseas are talking about, finished talking about a slowdown. Now it's more going towards perhaps a possible recession. Yeah, so obviously, you know, because these people are holding on to large assets like homes, it is a bit worrying for the economy.
So beyond the heavy hitters, what about ordinary middle class South Africans and even retirees, Andrew? How would they fare in comparison to that initial cohort? I'm assuming things are just as tough for them and also slipping into a deeper credit crisis.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, overall in South Africa, and it's, I always worry about talking about overall in South Africa because we are definitely a country of several different demographics, and they're very, very different from each other. If you look at just the income inequality in South Africa, I think it's top in the world. So, but if we do look overall, about 28% of income goes towards your monthly repayments. For the middle class, you know, you mentioned that the heavy hitters are 48%. The middle class are about 37% right now. So they're also, you know, over indexed in terms of debt to income repayments. Comfortable retirees, our group, sort of the wealthier 65 plus, they're looking about 22%, but that has been one that's been steadily growing over the last sort of 3 years that we've been looking at it. So yeah, it's getting challenging for retired people as well.
If we go back to those heavy hitters and the huge debt burden that they're carrying, are you also seeing increased default?
Yeah, so we saw the first uptick in the number of loans in default this quarter. I mean, that's a trend that had been going down since 2023, but it turned up this quarter. Following last quarter, we saw an uptick in arrears. So arrears is a month or more in overdue, but not 3 months. And then in default is you've actually gone into default more than 3 months overdue on your loan. So that is another number that did go up dramatically for the first time this quarter. But the other interesting number is the increase in overdue balances, $215 billion. And that's an 8.3%. It's 8.3% of the total outstanding debt. So that's another concerning number.
Andrew Fulton, at some point this balloon is going to pop, and one assumes that this could trigger a ripple effect, maybe tighter lending or more cautious credit practice across the economy. Or are we starting to see that already?
Well, I mean, that's the really interesting thing, because if you look at quarter two, in terms of macroeconomics, there are actually a lot of good news stories. You know, the Rand strengthened, consumer confidence was up, inflation fell to its lowest level, we had our fourth repo cut in a year, and it seems like perhaps the lending criteria was loosened a little bit, because we had the largest influx or the largest growth in credit numbers since we've had in COVID. So, you know, the number of new loans went up by 1.5 million new loans. So it's interesting that there was actually an easing, perhaps, of the credit taps. But yes, I mean, you know, these things do change quarter on quarter, and we'll see how the industries react to the most recent numbers that come in.
Do you apply your minds at all to any kind of policy or systemic change that is needed to address the risk among top-tier earners?
Yeah, I mean, you've obviously got your affordability criteria, which is a bit hard to measure sometimes, because it's often self-proclaimed, and you know, there are multiple sources of income at that sort of higher level of earnings. But yeah, I mean, I'd be a little bit lost to kind of suggest any policy suggestions at this stage. But, you know, more importantly, maybe people should just focus on what they can afford, live a little bit more within their means, make sure they've got a nest egg or a bit of a cushion for difficult economic times, because it looks like they could be ahead of us.
So the final message to everyday South Africans regarding managing debt, because we've been talking about the middle class and the heavy hitters, but it's not just the wealthy that are struggling. This is something that is going to permeate across all sections of the economy, I'm right.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess if I had any advice, it would be to just make sure you keep your head above water. If you get into trouble, there's debt counseling that's available, and try to cut your expenses back wherever you can, live within your means, and only use debt sparingly and when necessary.
Andrew Fulton, thank you very much indeed. He's from the research and consulting firm 8020.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South African corporates spent a record 12.7 billion rand on CSI programs last year, yet the country remains the most unequal in the world. That was the blunt message from the 2025 Serious Social Investing Conference hosted by Chikalulu Social Investments. Its chief executive officer, Leanne Emery-Hunter, says it's time to move beyond charity and compliance towards what she terms bold catalytic partnerships. Leanne, a very warm welcome to you, and let me put this to you bluntly, that business leaders are simply not doing enough. I'd suggest to you that CSI is still treated as a compliance exercise rather than a driver of systemic change. That certainly seems to be the subtext of your message at the conference.
Morning, Jeremy. Great to be here. So, yes, I think we as Business South Africa, and we work with a lot of big corporates that are doing really fantastic work and are deeply invested and committed. But with that being said, there is still entrenched poverty, youth unemployment is at untenable levels, and we face massive climate vulnerability. So I think while there are a number of pockets of excellence, we don't collaborate very well. I don't think the idea of strategic, systemic social investment and social impact work is new, but on the whole, I think there is an appetite, but potentially it is more complex, it is a more difficult road to take, but we need to partner better to be able to create more systemic long-term change. And some recent, you know, the recent USAID's withdrawal from South Africa has only made it more clear that we can't do things in silos. Otherwise, we're going to end up with like a whole vertical shattered. So it's really about what are the local systemic programs that can be implemented for change. And it's not easy because it means you need to work with government. You need to work potentially in partnership with other corporates. And so I am definitely, I feel hopeful and positive seeing the energy and passion in the room. But I think we all were in agreement that we need to kind of move from the dialogue to commitments.
So how do you do that? How do you harness the collaborative strategy that you're looking for?
So I think there's some good examples of organizations that are doing it well. We have a client, Optima, that's working in the education space, that pivoted their strategy from secondary school to early grade learning. And now they really work with government to develop curricula, infrastructure development, teacher training, and a whole host of collaborative efforts that we're already starting to see is a kind of different trajectory. Discovery Work uses their data very well to create systemic and community change. I think for me personally, what I'd like to see and what a number of us from the conference have committed to is from this conference, we are going to meet and say, okay, what are the collaborative projects that we immediately want to take on and report back on at the next conference?
How do you answer this criticism that CSI money is simply spread too thinly across small projects? Surely corporates need to consolidate efforts into fewer scalable intervention, and with that would come more intensified collaboration, surely?
I think that's a fair point, and it's the analogy of, you know, a community with five hospitals and no road. And I think for us, we really, I mean, there's certain sectors that we have do a lot of work in, like mining, where we working with the Minerals Council to see how do we play a convening role to assist in becoming more collaborative in the efforts that we take. And I think there definitely are too many silos. And so we as Chikalulu are trying to see from the data that we have, what are the interventions, particularly looking at either regions or sectors, that we can try and help play a convening role in this space. Because I think often the best intentions are there, but often NGOs or corporates are not even aware that others are doing things in similar spaces. And if we can try and collaborate together, I think the impact will be much greater.
The other hurdle, of course, that you've got to face is the trust in government principally, but also business to a point is low. How do you convince social investors or how do social investors convince communities that the partnerships are genuine, that they're well-meaning and not just a publicity stunt?
So I think trust is earned, right? So it's definitely, there's dialogue is to be had, but it's also about taking action and making good on the promises that you have made. And we've seen when you really bring communities into the discussions and the communications, the impact and the outputs are so much greater. My team often gives me the example of a community building that was built some years ago, and it won all sorts of design awards, but the community didn't actually use the building because the acoustics were so bad. And that's like just a really great example of the fact that the community was not engaged.
Point is taken, but you'll acknowledge community cynicism given that so many have been let down 100%. So many times before.
100%. So I think that's why it's so important to, A, engage communities upfront, ensure that you keep your promises, and then you keep the dialogue going and you report back on the impact of the project.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Leanne Emery-Hunter, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Chikalulu Social Investments. And that's also where we're going to leave it for this Thursday. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.